we'll just bring Al in. Let's bring Al Romero in. Okay. Al, I know Al a long time. He's a great stand-up comic. And I'm extremely jealous of Al because, I'll wait till he can hear me. I'm extremely jealous of our next guest because to be able to sit down and write a book is one of the most difficult things to do. The dedication it takes day after day to write. And John tells me, Al, it's a big book.
Yeah, I actually traced it. I
mean, how you been, Al? I haven't seen you.
How you doing, Al?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you doing?
We're good. We're just hanging out, waiting for a vaccine. You know, that's all.
Yeah, I know. That's what we're all waiting for. That.
We're just waiting for a vaccine.
Oh man,
so, I love. By the way, Al is a great stand-up, and we've all known each other for a long, long time in Florida. And I heard about the
book. How are you?
I'm great. And I heard about the book. And by the way, that's my wife, Dottie. Dottie, say hello to Al.
Of course, I know Dottie.
Yeah, we worked
together. Dottie has been my boss for a couple of times back in the 80s and 90s.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, in the MCL
days. All right, good.
Yeah.
We're all doing good. We just, you know, we started this thing to kill time, and now it's gotten bigger than we thought. Now we have to work every day, 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, an hour to get ready, an hour to finish. It's a long story. It's not as hard as writing a book. Let me begin with you decided to. I guess it was all these family stories about Cuba, and you decided to put it together. When you started it, did you really have an idea how much work and time and dedication? I mean, you can't stop once you get going, right?
Well, I wrote it as a screenplay first.
Okay.
And I tried to shop that around, and I actually got it optioned off to a small production company in North Carolina. And they owned the rights for the book for about 2 years. I mean, to the right of the story for about 2 years. But they budgeted the, and I understand why, because there's a lot of fighting scenes and stuff like that. But they budgeted the movie at $50 million. And for an independent film, that's a lot of money.
Yes, it is.
So they, in the 2 years, they couldn't raise the money. So the story reverted back to me. I threw it in a drawer. I left it there for quite a few years, actually. Mm-hmm. And then one day, I dusted it off, and I wrote it. I decided to write it as a book.
Yeah. Well, you know that Michael Crichton wrote ER 100 years ago. No one wanted it. Put it in a drawer. And then one day, everybody was interested in medical things on television. He took it back out, and the next thing you know, it was a hit. So maybe your timing is right. Plus, John's daughter.
Said
the easiest way to get a movie made is, you know, you tell the story, John. I'm stealing.
Well,
Alan,
I've had this conversation. Okay, yeah. That's why he sent it to her. Yeah, from now on, movie studios are not really looking for scripts. They're looking for books, like owned material.
That's one of the reasons I wrote it, by the way.
Yeah. And the title of the book is
Revolution.
Revolution. How?
There it is. There we go.
There we go. I love it. I love it. Castro lied, cheated, and murdered their way into power. You didn't pull any punches there.
No.
No, man. I mean, they didn't punch against my family. They killed members of my family. They took everything we had and that we owned. We had to leave everything behind. You know, I mean, really, seriously. People don't realize how drastic it was and how, you know, it's so hard to live in this country. I understand how something like that could happen, you know. This is not the story of my family. I wrote it as a novel because I didn't want to make it the story of my family. I didn't want to make it a documentary. I wanted to make it more interesting.
Sure.
And I wrote it for you guys.
Okay.
Because Cubans, we've been telling this story to each other from since 1959. But I wrote it for you guys because most people don't know what really happened in Cuba, how Castro came to power, you know, how other factions were involved, and, you know, how he pretended to be one thing, you know, to people like my uncle who fought with him and then turned out to be something completely different. So I wrote it as a novel to make it more interesting. You know, like The Godfather is the story. It's different mafia stories, mafia family put together into one family to tell the story. Well, I used the same formula.
Okay.
You know, I took this family, I took things that happened to my family, to other people, to other Cubans, the things that I read, to things that I known about, and put it all together into one family to tell the story. And when you write about a family, everybody has a family, so everybody can relate to it. You know what I'm saying? So it's easier for people to become more engaged with the characters when the characters are all related, and you can put yourself in different, I can relate to this character in my family. And you don't have to do it on a conscious level. You know, we'll do it on a subconscious level when we read and stuff like that. That's what attracts us to stories.
How did you and your family get out of Cuba?
I came here on what is called the Peter Pan flight. I don't know if you guys are familiar with
we're
that.
Not.
Okay.
We're not.
Okay. Sometime in 1960, Fidel Castro, or the rumors were around that the government were going to take over the education of the children, and they were going to send them to government-run schools away from the parents, you know, like a boarding school.
Sure.
And they'll be off part of the summer, because part of the summer they also had to volunteer to cut cane, because you build character according to the Communist Party. So you will only build character.
Yeah, hello.
So you only spend part of the time, like maybe 2 months out of the year, with your parents. And parents were nuts. They were going crazy. I remember my parents talking about, with other families, about barricading and you know, and they'll have to kill me before they take my kids, all that type of stuff. And it was going around. And so the Catholic Church came up with this idea that they will take the kids by themselves, because in order to leave Cuba, you had to turn everything into the government. Okay, that was like the blackmail. And you cannot leave it to your family. It's not like, okay, I'm going to move to another country. I'm going to leave my house, my car, my TV to my sister. No, you have to turn it into the government. Wow. Okay, so there was paperwork and stuff like that, and you have to apply. But for whatever reason, a child going under the Catholic Church with some kind of, I don't really understand it, but some kind of humanitarian or kind of, I don't know, to tell you the truth, how to word it. But the point is that we're letting kids come to the United States through the Catholic Church program by themselves. And most kids went to orphanage right here in the Keys called Matacumbe Key, which is the first very small key, but very first key right after you get out of the continental part of Florida. And I was very lucky. My family, my aunt came 3 weeks before me by a fluke. And I went to live with her, and so I didn't have to live in an orphanage. But that's how I came. And my parents, I was very lucky. My parents came 6 months later, which was very lucky, because some kids waited years before they saw their parents again.
You know, first of all, my mouth always runs off. Oh, I forgot to thank you, by the way, for taking your time to be here today and being generous with your time. It means a lot. I am when John.
Well, I understand, because I am so busy. I, the moment I get up in the morning is like I have so much things to do. Yeah. You know, I have to watch George Judy. I mean, it's very, very hectic life that I live nowadays.
One of the things I try not to do is talk about things I know nothing about, and I'm definitely going to read your book, because I'm very interested, because obviously, you know, there's conversations on both sides about Cuba, whether have relations with Cuba and all the other good stuff. And you hear these things spinning around in the air from people that really don't know what the hell they're talking about at the end of the day, unless you've actually lived it like you lived it, to know what it feels like to have everything taken away from you and escape to a foreign country. It's just unheard of, because we live in this society. Lately, everybody seems to hate this country beyond me. We live in a great country where there's so much freedom, and nobody's trying to take your TV. Well, maybe, but if you're not home, they might be trying to take your TV. So I think it's just interesting. But I'm curious. I haven't read the book yet. Since it is a novel, were you able to kill Castro early?
No, we don't kill Castro because it's a historical novel.
Oh, all right.
Although it's fictionalized, it does follow historical.
If you got rid of him in chapter 7, it would help everybody.
You know, yeah, I know, but then it would have been no story, though, you know.
It would be a very short book.
A short book.
Yeah, exactly.
But with a happy ending.
No, but when you write a historical novel, you actually have to make it historically factual.
Yeah.
The characters can be fictitious.
Yeah.
The situation you put the characters might be fictitious,
yeah.
but it has to be historically correct.
Yeah. And they're interesting. You know, I'm not bringing this name up for any other reason that he does this. Newt Gingrich, along with another writer, takes moments in history and then rewrites it to what would have happened if it went in that direction instead of the direction it went. But it's all based in historical fact to start with, and they just kind of twist the ending.
Yeah, they do a twist. I love history. I had a double major. It was one of my majors, so I love history. I love to write historical novels.
That's amazing. That's really good stuff. Yeah. Go ahead, Dottie.
Do you still have family in Cuba?
No, most of, I will say all of my family, it was either came to the United States or died of old age.
Oh, okay.
I think I might have some distant cousins or something like that, but I would not even recognize me.
Okay.
You know, I don't know them.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have a relationship with them.
Mm-hmm. Dottie and I have both had the opportunity to visit Cuba in the last couple of years.
Yes.
Obviously, when the cruise ship started going there, it became the hot spot.
Everybody was curious.
Yeah,
you know?
And I honestly was bothered somewhat by it because it, for a lot of the people, it was like a novelty. But I'm still looking at it as people that don't have enough, don't have freedom, and I'll tell a story and you tell me if it rings true to you. But what our guide was a history professor in the United States in Brooklyn or the Bronx, and he came back to Cuba because I wanted to go back to my country, and he taught and he was a guide, and he said to us that the biggest import for the Cuban people are their sons and daughters who go to America, become doctors. They do really well, and then they send the money back to them. Do you know that to be true? Is that possible?
Cubans in the United States send over $2 billion back to relatives in Cuba in the form of money or goods or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Over $2 billion every year.
Are they allowed to keep it, though?
We are keeping that regime alive, basically. And you talking about the embargo before. It's such a complicated issue, man, because you know, what happens is that on the one hand, you know, the definition of insanity is to continue to do the same thing, expecting a different result. The embargo obviously has not worked. The regime is still there. They're still subjugating people. So it hasn't worked. But then what happens is when you open things up, it's only going to open up as much as they want to, as much as they can siphon it into a little tube that they can control everything that comes into Cuba. So it's not that we're going to start a relationship with Cuba and everybody's going to be free and happy and singing kumbaya. It's not going to be like that. The government's going to control everything. So what happens is that when you start opening up and you start doing things like investing money and stuff like that, the only people that actually benefit from that is the government.
That's it.
Because everything is controlled by the government.
Yeah.
Anything that makes money in Cuba, any industry that makes money in Cuba is controlled by the military.
Tourism
is controlled by the military.
When we go there, they have a separate tourist dollar. We have to change our money for a tourist dollar, not the Cuban currency. And then when we're done, we change it back. And of course, there's a fee for changing it in, changing it out. And,
of course.
And you cannot use credit cards or American dollars there. You must use the Cuban tourist dollar because it is controlled by the government.
And they charge you a fee. It's funny how communists always, you know, find a capitalistic way of getting money from you.
Exactly right. And I will say the cars are amazing. I put this in my act because we're in Havana and we're looking at these cars. And this guy had a 1953 Pontiac that was spectacular. And I refused to ride in it. And he said, why? I said, because it was built the same year I was born, and it's in a hell of a lot better shape. I'm not getting in that car. I'll see you later. I mean,
and you know what's amazing about those cars is that the whole entire mechanical and drive shaft system have been replaced in a very ingenious way by non-educated mechanics, engineers, but by your corner mechanic, into using Russian Latas, which is is the Russian Fiat, and converted them to work with an American system, which is amazing.
Because they couldn't get parts since like 1950.
Of course,
But
can you adapt that, you know? But
that's,
I mean, hey, listen, necessity is the mother of invention. it's so funny. Actually, they had it on display in here in Southwest 8th Street for a while. There was a guy that took a truck and converted it into an amphibian truck.
Yeah.
And actually drove a Ford truck into the United States over the water.
No kidding.
He converted into an amphibian. And the Coast Guard standing there watching.
Oh, my word.
This 50-something Ford truck coming at them on the water. And the guy behind the wheel.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's so courageous. And you think about it, and then obviously the joke would be, and when he landed, not only did he get to stay, but Ford Motor Company hired him the next day. He's the vice president of engineering now. How do you get one of our trucks to float, let alone keep running?
And they gave him the ticket for no inspection.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell you one thing. I'm very proud of my people here. We humans have, maybe because a lot of the people that came in the first wave were, you know, entrepreneurs and business people and stuff like that, because we came here for a political reason rather than an economic one. So more, you know, a little more educated with a background, stuff like that. But Cubans take into the American system like fish to water, man. Mm-hmm. You know, and Cubans have done very, very well in this country. We represent 0.5% of all the Latinos in this country. 0.5%. There's 3 Latino senators in Congress. Yeah. They're all Cuban Americans. Yeah.
The CEO of Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, which is the parent company of Oceania Cruise Line, Frank Del Rio, came here from Cuba when he was six years old.
He grew up with my cousin.
Is that right? Yeah, he's done pretty good.
Because he's a very good friend of it.
Yeah. He's done very, very good. Well, tell us about the book. I saw you were on C-SPAN. You've been out doing book signing. I guess, I know it's available, right? Amazon, all the major booksellers.
Well, actually, the good thing about it is that you can get it anywhere. Yeah. A few store has it. Like, they had it at the airport, on the store. But you have to be a famous writer to take that shell space, what I'm saying?
It's a closed system.
They're not going to get put on an unknown and given shell space. But you can go to any bookstore in the United States or any online bookstore in the United States and put Revolution by Al Romero and you can buy it. You can go to the store and order it, or you can buy it and order it online in anything, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, whatever.
How many drafts? Just one?
Well, now remember, I wrote her as a screenplay first.
Yeah.
So I already had like a guideline, as to what I wanted to do. I mean, writing a book and writing a screenplay are two completely different things, because in a screenplay, you give suggestions to the director and the director films the book or the screenplay the way he sees it. Mm-hmm. You in the comments you write, the guy go to the corner and gets in a car. Now, the type of car that the director picks, the type of car that, so you give basically an outline of what's going to happen in that scene, and the director fills it in with his own idea. On a book, you have to fill it in. Mm-hmm. You can't just get in a car. You have to actually tell a little bit about the car, tell about what the guy was wearing. They're walking down the street, describe the street. So, I mean, it becomes a lot more complicated. I have never taken a writing course in my life, ever. No. I wrote tell you how I wrote it from a layman's perspective. I wrote it as an actor director seeing a scene in my head, and I will describe it on the computer. That's the way I will see it. Instead of writing something, because I'm not a writer, I don't even know how writers write. I will see it as from perspective of an actor or a director. I will see the whole scene in my head, and then I will start writing at what I see, and then I will go back and add it and change it and modify a little bit. But that's how I wrote it, which is, I don't think that's the way.
Well, you got there. I mean, John's daughter could give us all the course, but because she went to Yale and everywhere, and she knows that there's certain things you have to have in a screenplay, certain things you should have in a novel. I know only from reading novels, but the idea.
Let me stop you there before you're going to finish. You'd be surprised how much you know about writing a book if you are a person that reads a lot.
Yeah, well, that's
because
the thing.
I will sit there. There will be some times that I will be sitting in front of my computer. I will spend 7, 8, 9 hours a day writing. I mean, just pour out of me. And I will sit there and I will go, how do I know that?
Yeah.
How do I know to do this? How do I know when to end this and start the next chapter, and when to go from this scene that I'm describing to the next scene with the other characters and make it flow naturally? How do I know how to do that? I don't know. I never took a course in that. And it was all by osmosis, by reading so much that I just kind of knew how to do it from reading other authors, you know?
And they tell you that if you're going to sit down and write a screenplay or a script, the first thing you have to do is read 50 scripts, and you get an idea of how it goes. Same with books. I used to read.
Exactly.
I would read, but I know when you sit down to write it, it just takes how long after you took the screenplay out of the drawer and said, "Oh, all right, I'll make it a novel." A year.
It took me a year.
Yeah.
Now remember, you know, although I'm a college graduate, my English is my second language,
sure.
And my grammar and my syntax is horrendous. I mean, I will get A minuses in colleges because I knew the subject matter, but they will take it off because my writing and my syntax was so horrendous, you know. But I had a friend, Dave Kelly. You know, Dave. You know Dave Kelly?
There was a comedian, right?
Yeah, the comedian. The guy that used to have a white spot right here. Mary Aggie from East Side Comedy.
Do you know who he's talking about, John?
John.
I just know him from Florida.
Mary Aggie?
Aggie from East Side Comedy Club. She used to work. She was actually the one that designed the logo for East Side Comedy Club. And he ended up marrying her. He had a short guy, Irish guy, brown hair. But he had a spot right here, gray hair, you know? Well, anyways, we've been friends for many, many years. What I will do is I will write, and I will send it to him, and he will clean up the grammar and the spelling and stuff like that. And sometimes will actually correct my syntax, you know, and then will send it back to me. And sometimes I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense the way he changed it. Otherwise, I said, no. And I will not argue, but I will go back to him. I said, Dave, no, I this might be the way is grammatically
correct.
Yeah,
but not the way you speak. It has to be the
way
you speak.
But it's not the way I want to tell the story or the way the characters speak. So I want to go back to the incorrect way, you know?
Well, it's the same thing with your act. If you ever write jokes down that you've used for 100 years and you write exactly the way you say it, and then you look at it
I don't know
paper.
That because I come up with a new act every day.
Every day. But what I'm saying is you look at what you wrote and you go, that doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, and then you write it the way it should be right, you know, the way you think it should be written, and then it doesn't work.
But comedy is not supposed to make
sense.
That's
exactly how I felt when I did my first condo.
Yeah.
And all the old people looking at me like going,
the hell he said?
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. But it's not supposed to. I tell people that. If you take comedy apart, it does. You go, that doesn't make any sense. And people, you know.
No, because it's so real. That's what comedy is. You take something and exaggerate it in order to make it funny.
There's a joke that I do that someone gave me years and years ago about the lady. Lady goes into the store, pharmacy, and she wants to buy. Did I get it right? It's the guy that goes to the store, right, Daddy?
Mm-hmm.
3 months. I don't know what the hell I do anymore. And she wants to buy. He wants to buy cyanide. And the pharmacist said, "What do you want cyanide for?" And he said, "I'm going to kill my wife." And the scientist says, the pharmacist says, "I can't sell you cyanide to kill your wife." So the guy reaches in his pocket. He takes out a picture of his wife, and he shows it to the druggist. And the druggist said, "I didn't tell you didn't tell me you had a prescription." Okay, now. Now, here's what's funny about that, off the subject, but the joke was originally written, I'm told, it was a female that walked into the pharmacy, asked for cyanide, druggist said, "I can't sell you cyanide to kill your husband." She reached in her pocket and showed the druggist a picture of her husband, of his wife.
With her husband.
Yeah, help me out here. I don't get what
his wife with her husband.
Yeah, and he said, "Oh, you didn't tell me you had a prescription." Either way, the joke makes no sense at all. A picture of somebody is not a prescription. But everybody connects those dots and laughs. But if you take it apart, you go, wow, that doesn't make any sense at all. So
no, it's the irony of right. the thing. That's what you know.
And also, the last 2 minutes I spoke didn't make any sense. So there you go. I need to get more than 4 hours sleep. That's all I need to do.
By the way, when's the last time any of you guys worked on stage? When's the last time?
For me, it was March 15th, I guess.
About five months, just like me.
I got off the ship March 18th.
How about you, John?
Before that.
Yeah.
Before that, I did a magic convention before that, you know, probably.
Hey, listen, it's happening. Minervini's working. Richie's at, you know, in somebody's garage. He doesn't care.
That's how Alan and I met.
For Richie?
Yeah, you know that? You know that story?
No.
John met?
No.
Tell this story. Okay. I'm living in L.A. I have met Richie the very first night I did stand-up. Richie was there in Florida on vacation. He was there. He came by because he saw a comedy club. So I met him the very first night we did comedy. Became friends. Richie's a very friendly guy. Everybody loves Richie. So I moved, you know, a year or so later, you know, I moved to L.A. So I'm living in L.A. So I'm coming to do his club, the Eastside Comedy Club. And I said to him that, you know, I have no way to stay, and I can't afford hotels in New York. So he says, no, stay with me, you know. And he's right by the club, you know. Somebody come pick you up, and that, you know, if anything. So come stay with me. So I say, okay, fine. So now I get off. I take, the shuttle, whatever, from JFK over to Long Island. So nobody's there. Knock on the door. Nobody's there. The door's not open. I look to see that somebody left the key, nowhere. Now, this is before cell phone, so I have no way of calling anybody. I don't even know where there's a payphone around. I mean, the guy just dropped me at an address in a neighborhood. So now I'm standing there trying to figure out what the hell I'm going to do, and here comes John with suitcases and duffel bags. And I'm going to myself, this doesn't look good.
What, did your wife throw you out?
So wait. Well, I don't know what happened with his wife, but he shows up and he tells me, he looks at me, he goes, are you staying here? And I go, yeah, you? He goes, yeah. He goes, freaking Richie.
Didn't leave a key?
He knew immediately that, you know, I didn't even have to tell him what happened. He immediately said, freaking Richie. You know, so I tell him, I basically, you know, threw myself at his mercy. I said, listen, man, I'm from LA. I don't know anybody here. I have no place to stay. I can't call a friend. I don't have money to get a hotel room. I haven't even gotten paid. I haven't started. And John says, let me see what I can do. So you went, I guess you found a payphone or something. I called somebody. So he calls somebody, comes back, he says, I got a friend. I'm going to go to stay with a friend. And nice meeting you, whatever, you know. Tell Richie to go screw himself or whatever you told me to tell him. You know. Well, the friend that he ended up staying with ended up being his second wife. So I play indirectly Cupid to this relationship because they started a relationship shortly after that.
Know that. You learn something new every day. How about that? Yeah, Richie was just on the other day, so we love him. He's, you know.
It's like Kevin Bacon. Every show, there's seven stages of Minervini.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, exactly. But Richie is, he's working on Port Charlotte this week at Vazzani's. And then he's working.
Yeah, he's a hustle, man. He finds work everywhere.
And he's working.
What happened was I had an apartment and I was moving into another apartment. And Richie goes, I'm just going to stay in a hotel. Richie goes, no, you don't have to. You come stay with me. My house is always open. My house is always open for you. You know, you just stay with me. It's not a problem. And I go, really? And he goes, when are you coming? I tell him the night it was. I get there and there's poor Al standing there. Yeah, Richie told me I could stay here. And I'm going, well, I'm thinking there's only one room. We're certainly not staying together.
But that was nice. That was nice of you because you didn't know me from Adam. You could have, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was very nice, you know. And, you know, it cost you a marriage, you know. I cost you a marriage.
There you go.
I created a marriage for you.
There you go. We are talking.
But, you know, I was asking you guys how long we've done a show because I have one tomorrow and I'm scared out of my mind, man. I don't remember I don't remember my act. I'm watching it on DVD, and I go, and I can't follow it. I can't anticipate.
Well, we better not promote it then.
Where are you working?
I'm working for our friend
Larry.
Larry Silver.
Larry, we do not speak.
Larry and John had a lover spat. So
Really? I didn't know that. What happened?
Don't tell me you were on the show.
It's a long story. Long story.
Okay. Well, I'll get Larry's version tomorrow.
Are you at a?
Oh God.
Are you at Club? Are you Club 52 or you're at Port St. Lucie?
I'm in Port St. Lucie.
Port St. Lucie.
Yeah, Club 52 hasn't opened yet.
All right. Is that
Port St. Lucie changed? It's not the same place anymore.
Oh, you're kidding. That was a great room. No. Larry got mad at me.
I hear this one. It's not. I hear this is a great restaurant with great food.
In the country club then? Or a different one?
I don't know where it is. I have the address. It's the name of a restaurant.
Okay. Is it the Italian place?
Yeah, it's an Italian place. Let me see if I can find it on my
I did a gig here. For Larry.
If it is, cancel.
No.
No, I just talked to him. John, I talked to him yesterday, so I know he's
Stewart.
Not.
That one's a Stewart.
But oh, okay.
Larry's Port St. Lucie that he had, he got mad at me because I told him it was the best gig he ever booked. And he goes, all my gigs are great. I go, Larry, I've known you for 25 years. Stop it.
The first so this time- was be apparently a new room for him, right?
There you go.
Because
he put a good act in.
All right, calm down.
I think the other guys, the owner decided to stop doing comedy.
All right. He
moved to another place. He moved someplace else.
But that country club was a sweet gig. The audience was great and it was a lot of fun. I performed there and Dottie was with me and my cousin and her boyfriend came and I picked
Well, the country club's still working, but that's a different one than Club 52 though.
That's Melbourne. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Melbourne. Right.
Yeah, that's
one is
that's open.
It's called let me tell you what it is. Tutto Fresco.
Oh, yeah.
It's a restaurant. It's supposed to be a really nice Italian restaurant. It's called Tutto Fresco. Yeah.
That's not the one that had the big stage, Tom, is it?
I think it is, yeah. Yeah, if it's that one, it's really nice. Big stage, nice people. They'll be able to social distance.
And only 50% capacity.
Yeah. Well,
which is good for Larry's rooms because they never get 50%.
Shut up. Stop it. Stop picking on Larry.
Yeah. I'm going to tell him that first thing out of my mouth says, Ferentino said you found the perfect formula for your comedy club. A worldwide pandemic.
Yeah, that ought to go over well.
Once again, we are talking to Al Romero. The book is called Revolution, How Castro Lied, Cheated, and Murdered.
And murdered his way into power.
Yeah, I love that title. I can say that title all day long. And you can find it in on
That's how Tom got this job.
Yeah. But you know what I want to do? What I want to do with a book is one of the reasons John and I were talking about it. He said he was going to give it to his daughter. Is that I think that the book, because still, if you read it, it reads almost like a film because that's actually how I wrote it.
Sure.
You know, I think it will make a great a short series like in Amazon or Netflix or Hulu or something like that. So that's what I'm trying to concentrate now. How do I get that in the hands of people that make decisions, especially Netflix, which now are building their own studios and they're going to start producing their own products. So they don't even have to wait for anybody. They can buy a book and decide to do it.
And they're not afraid of period pieces. They're not afraid of historical pieces.
And they have one of the biggest budgets of production.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they're very,
And they have some awful stuff. They put some awful things out. So
They need content. They need content. But you have to get it to the right person.
Yeah, that's my problem. So
it hasn't been forgotten with my daughter, by the way.
Yeah.
What was that?
It hasn't been forgotten with my daughter,
good,
by
good,
the way.
Good. Well, I hope so. I hope so because, if she has an in with Netflix, it makes it easier. But I'm going to try Amazon, and I'm going to try Hulu, and I'm going to try all the streaming channels,
Well, and as Lindsay said about the options, there are people out there, they're always looking to option something because, like that company did, but obviously you had too many fight scenes, which are really the best part of any movie, you know. And I now, is it set, what year is it set in? Is
okay,
current day?
It starts in 1956 when Castro lands in well, actually start with a prologue, you know. I always like that. I have a prologue and an epilogue. But after the prologue, it starts with Castro landing in Oriente with a yacht, the Granma, with the 82 people, and getting gunned down, and only a handful of them survive, getting into the, you know, into the mountains. And then he switches over to the family to show one of the guys that survive is one of my main characters, who is one of the members of the family. So I switch now back to the family to show life in Cuba, in Havana, what's going on. So I go back and forth showing what the rebels are doing in the mountains, what, how the revolution is going, back to how life is going on in Havana, you know. And that basically is the movie, until all the forces join together, which is when he wins the revolution, and then the family and the, you know, they reunite, and that will become part two. And part two is when Fidel start turning on everybody,
sure,
including the people that fought with him, and started showing what he really was, but all behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know? It sounds great, and I am determined this weekend to read it, because I need to
terrific.
I need to take a break.
I will hear. Give me some feedback after you read it.
I would love to. I would love to.
Yeah,
and we want to thank you. We're 12:01, so we had that was a nice conversation. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you coming on board. I've said it already. All I ever wanted out of the show was to be interesting and have some fun and connect old friends. We haven't seen each other.
Yeah, man, nice seeing you, Dottie.
It's
been a long, long time.
It has
been. And you too. You know, there's another guy with your name, another comedian with your name.
Yeah, he's a juggler comedian, Tommy Drake.
Tommy Drake.
I got a call years ago or an email years ago. Friends of mine wanted tickets to see Cher. I go, well, buy him. They said, no, you're opening for Cher. I go, I'm not opening for Cher. It says right here, Tommy Drake's opening for Cher. And I go, that's the other one. I'm opening for nobody. Buy your own tickets. So, yeah, he was Houston-based, I think, at one time. I'm not sure where he is.
Yes, he was.
Yeah,
he was.
And also a guy that's been on ships like all of us for a while. So
oh, yeah, for a long time, yeah.
Well, you know Patrick Murray. Did you ever work with Patrick and Matilda? The ventriloquist?
Yes.
Well, Patrick was on our show before. I think we even had social media. Mm-hmm. When we started, we just did internet-based radio. Now, once we went on Facebook and YouTube Live and Twitch and Periscope and DLive, it's a bigger audience all over the place. But Patrick was with us. He lives outside of Vancouver. And we were talking about the old days of cruising when with Region, not Region Seven Seas, but Region Cruise Lines, which was a Greek-run line. Mm-hmm. And that's where Patrick started. And he got talking about working with the Greek captains, which can always be such fun. And and he just does a killer impression or characterization of a captain when things aren't going all that well. And I liked it so much that we use it to get out of the show with. And we thank you. Once again, it's Revolution. And
By Al Romero.
By Al Romero, and you can find it everywhere, and I look forward to reading it. Al, all the best, man. I'm so happy for
Same
you.
Same here. Nice seeing you guys.
Good to see you,
Al. Again after Thank all this you, year. Nice seeing you,
guys. All right, hang in. Bye-bye, guys. We're going to go out of here with Patrick if I hit the right button.